E.L. Doctorow is our guest here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was just asking about, what I'm hearing at least, is the role of the artist.
Actually, I was asserting, but I was working my way to a question.
Asserting the role of the artist in saying that which is unpopular, that which those there are people who would rather you not say.
Well, there is some kind of transgressive impulse that I think the writer has. In fact, you have to work, usually, if anything's going to be any good, with a sense that you really shouldn't be doing this. You're going over the line here. And I have found that when I have that feeling, the work is good. And when I don't have that feeling, it doesn't pan out. This might have happened to me from the very beginning. I've told this story before, but I was a student at the Bronx High School of Science, and I always wanted to write. I was surrounded by these insufferably brilliant science and math students, some of whom were going around predicting correctly, as it turned out, that they would someday win the Nobel Prize in Physics.
Oh, my.
How tedious.
And so there was an English elective, a journalism class, which I hopped to, and we had the assignment to do an interview. So I really went to town on this and turned in an interview with the doorman at Carnegie Hall, stage doorman, Carl. He was a German-Jewish refugee.
Fabulous.
He'd escaped Hitler, and he came to work in an old baggy blue serge jacket and brown pants, sweet old man, and he brought his lunch in a paper bag and a thermos of tea, and he used to drink the tea in the old world style by putting a cube of sugar in his teeth and drinking it that way. And he's very knowledgeable about music and all the great artists, Horowitz and Rubinstein and Toscanini. They loved him, and it was Carl the doorman. So the teacher read this, and she called me up after class one day. She said, "You know, this is probably the best piece I've ever seen come out of this class. I've been teaching for many years. It's so good, I think we ought to run it in the school newspaper. And what I want to do is send one of the photography kids down to Carnegie Hall, take Coral's picture." I said, "Well, I don't think you can do that." And she said, "Well," I said, "well, he's very shy." And she said, "What do you mean he's shy? He talked to you, didn't he?" And I said, "Well, not exactly. There is no Carl. I made him up."
Fabulous.
I just thought there should make so much more sense to make something up than go through the tedious business of interviewing someone. Or maybe, you know, as a kid, I was too shy. I figured anyone I chose would say no, or I don't know what it was, but it worked out this way. And, of course, I was in deep trouble. Got an F.
Oh, no.
Yes, and neither the teacher realized what a portent this was. But it was that, and when I was writing it, I remember I kept saying to myself, "You're really breaking a rule here. There's some propriety that's being offended." And that's always been the feeling that from the very beginning. Of course, if I was defending myself now to the teacher, I'd say, I've only done what journalists have always done,
which is make it up.
Well, there's a certain amount.
Well, you fill in the blanks. How would that be?
But I
did you have that feeling with the march? That feeling of breaking the rules?
Yeah, I did. I did. I can't precisely describe where the transgression, what its point was. But there was that excitement of breaking some. There are some technical rules I break in the book, which gave me pleasure. One is that you don't introduce a major character halfway through the book. Well, I've done that. Another is that you don't kill off a character who the readers had reason to identify with, and I've done that.
Regularly.
Early on.
Those are technical transgressions.
Well, and you don't go through the same kind of act one, act two, act three, and at 60% something happens and those sort of structural bonds.
What interested me about this march was that it was unlike anything else in the Civil War. It is true that Grant did something of the same kind of thing in Mississippi, but it was Sherman who had the awful vision of going through three states and living off the land and just sweeping everything before him.
You say regularly that this is a classic warrior mode, that there is something very ancient about this.
Yeah. He knew that, and he and other people knew that, and he was compared to the various epic monsters of ancient days, Attila the Hun and so on. His idea was basically to destroy the infrastructure in the South, to go through and destroy the armories, capture the cotton. Cotton was very important, was the great source of finance for the Confederate cause, because the English textile mills were gobbling up every bale of cotton that they could produce. So he would find cotton and appropriate it or burn it, and the armories and the various state machine tool shops and where they made the rifles, and he destroyed whatever he could find that the South lived on and maintained its rebellion.
Well, my recollection is he set out to destroy the capacity to make more war and the will to make war. And it's interesting in watching this flow that at some point near the end he turns back to attacking armies rather than the infrastructure.
Well, you talk about it as the inverse of the Industrial Revolution. It's as if you were watching the film in reverse.
Yeah. Then they took the railroad ties and made them white hot. They have bonfires, and then they put the rails on the bonfire, twisted the rails so they couldn't be used again. They destroyed the railroads. where there was resistance, the people suffered. His rule was, if people don't resist you, leave them alone. They resist you, act commensurately. So that's how plantations were burned down. But of course, they needed livestock to feed the men. So there were great droves of cattle at the back of the march, and they needed the horses and mules. So they just took everything. They took the fodder. They took the corn from the corn crib. They took the sweet potatoes, the cured hams, everything that could be of any use. They took everything with wheels. And this is, after a while, I realized it wasn't just the soldiers marching. It was the whole civilization. Because the freed slaves knew that if they stayed behind, they were going to be in bad trouble. There was no civil government established in the wake of Sherman's march. So they latched on, and then the dispossessed whites often did that too, or perhaps they were northern sympathizers, and the people in the town knew that. So they had to get out, and pretty soon it was an entire civilization. I think of this as a road novel. It's the ultimate road novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's got a buddy piece in it too. Yeah.
Right. Well, and it's an army of 60,000, and then there's everybody else.
Mm. And one of the characters thinks of it as an enormous creature of 100,000 feet, just gobbling up everything in its path. So it wasn't the military nature of the event that appealed to me finally as I was writing the book. It was the idea that people's states of being were totally changed. The only thing then we had Hurricane Katrina, and some people who were down there and involved in it said, this is what they must have felt like when Sherman came through.
Utter devastation.
Yeah. Total dispossession. Life was transformed, and people had nothing.
Never to be the same again.
And they had their freedom, which, in effect, was an abstract thing in their mind, and they had to get used to that too. And of course, so much of it was betrayed, and
Well, for the next century, it's a lot of what you've written about in your intervening books is the betrayal of that.
At the end of the book, after Joe Johnston has surrendered to Sherman, Sherman begins to think of Johnston almost enviously. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah. Indeed.
Because Sherman would wonder about what he'd done for the rest of his life, whereas Joe Johnston, in his rage and humiliation, sense of loss and tragedy, would sublime he and his fellows to a fury, a rage that would empower them for a century, which really is what happened.
E.L. Doctorow tells this story, of course, elegantly, as he always does, in The March. We will be back, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, and E.L. Doctorow, in a moment. Please do be with us when we return.